Phoenix City.
G'day everybody, welcome to Saturday's AMA, a bit of a special episode this one. We're calling this one the Jet City Knicks Dream. We're twinned up with the guys from Phoenix City Podcast, so it's a big welcome to Patrick from the aforementioned podcast. G'day Pat, how you going mate?
Hello, how you doing? Joining you from across the Tasman, hopefully part of some sort of Trans-Tasman bubble soon, but yeah, thanks for inviting me on and good to be chatting to you.
Yeah, no, good to speak to you after such a long time, because you've obviously been over in England for ages and things have been up and down the last couple of seasons for both clubs, but is the lockdowns all over and done with over in New Zealand, or
yeah,
are they easing?
So we're basically just normal life, but border restrictions now. So it's pretty normal, which is actually really nice going back to some sort of normality. I flew back from London very quickly, so it was quite nice to be able to see my own city again, despite having been here for two months. But I think it's the same way for you. You're starting to ease a little bit in lockdowns, aren't you?
Yeah. It looks like we might be getting crowds back in the next couple of weeks. Fingers crossed that's going to mean good things for the A-League. But whether anyone's going to actually broadcast it is going to be another thing we can't really get it about at the moment. But the main reason we're here is to speak to former New Zealand, Wellington Phoenix, New Zealand Knights and current Jets keeper, Glenn Moss. Mossy, thanks for joining us, mate. Really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure, boys. What a great idea.
Yeah, we thought, Pat and I are well known to each other, and we have done one of those collaborations before. Well, it would be about, what, 4 or 5 seasons ago now, Pat?
Yeah.
Yeah. We thought it would be good to join forces and actually be and actually do this together, considering you've spent a great deal of time at both clubs, and you're and it looks like this might be your last one, Mossy, so we'll get into that. But to kick things off, I suppose, how have you found trying to keep fit and trying to keep occupied during all this COVID-19 stuff? And now that there's finally light at the end of the tunnel, how are things changing over the next couple of weeks to get ready for the season to get back underway?
Yeah, what an amazing time and in history, I guess. Firstly, keeping occupied hasn't been a problem with two young children, that's for sure.
Yep.
Keeping fit, on the other hand, has been more of we're lucky at the Jets. We've got a pretty good, medical team and sports science team, and we've got programs from our fitness trainer and concept gyms giving us exercise bikes and some gym equipment and stuff like that. So we've been ticking over as much as you can on your own. As I said, chasing the kids around the backyard's probably been my highest intensity of workout I've done so far.
How have you found communication with both the club and the PFA about what's happening during this period and how we're going to come out of it?
Well, look, there's probably been limited information, but in their defense, there's not too much to say, guys. In terms of the team and the squad and medical staff have been fantastic staying in touch with the players, as Laurie McKenna and Joel Griffiths at the club, and the players' union obviously working hard behind the scenes to push things along. But unfortunately, it's, I guess, out of the club's hands and the players' hands, and it's come down to the federation and the broadcaster to basically strike a deal and get it back up and running. And the players have agreed to what I think is a massive, massive pay cut to complete the season and do the right thing. The government's now, allowed games to begin, and it's funny because you drive past NPL clubs and there's young kids training and senior teams training, and we're not allowed to because we're essentially waiting for the politics to settle itself out and let us return to training.
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a it's an interesting situation. But we'll go back to the beginning, Mossy. Whereabouts did you grow up and where did you start playing your football?
Yeah, so I was born in New Zealand, and in the late 80s, mum and dad, probably with a lot of other Kiwis, moved to the Gold Coast. Gold Coast was booming at the time. All the high-rises were going up, and dad was in the hotel industry. So growing up on the Gold Coast was an awesome childhood. Played plenty of sports, you know, beach surfing lifestyle, you know, it was pretty hard to beat. And fell in love with football, really. There was a junior club at Runaway Bay next to my school, and in the lunch times we'd get out there and have a kick and a play, and then be over there again after school for club training, and just really fell in love, especially with goalkeeping from then on. And stayed on the Gold Coast until I finished high school in 2000 before chasing a professional dream.
When you said you fell in love with the game during that time, was that just purely by playing with it, or was it by watching football? Did you have a team that you supported while you were growing up?
No, purely just playing it, guys. And this is, I guess, the thing that I look back on, and, you know, I had Kiwi parents that still don't know what offside means.
I know that feeling, Mossy.
Absolutely, there was absolutely zero pressure to, you know, have a career in the game at all. It was just, look, if you love the game, we'll sign you up year after year, you know, take you to training, take you to the games. I didn't have a favorite club. I didn't watch it on TV. There wasn't a lot televised in the 90s, especially on free-to-air stuff. It was getting up at 4 a.m. and watching some of the Premier League or World Cup, depending where it was. And like I said, just playing at lunchtime and after school. And, you know, I remember being in tears sometimes on Tuesday or Thursday afternoon when it was raining, because this is, again, the time before WhatsApps and group messages and this kind of stuff. And mum would just see the rain and say, oh, well, you know, training's washed out. There'll be no training. I'd be in tears. I'd make mum drive me down to training just so I could see that there was nobody on the fields and there was a, you know, park closed sign on it. And only then would I be, I guess, relatively happy to go back home and sleep it off.
Well, it's certainly interesting, Mossy, that Gold Coast and New Zealand's not really known for, obviously, rugby union dominates everything over there. And Gold Coast has had so many professional teams, but it really seems that the local leagues it seems to be a really strong culture around the local sports. But why is Gold Coast as an area struggled for? I mean, I think there's AFL team struggles to get people. They've had obviously Gold Coast United have come and gone. They've had a rugby league team there twice, I think. And what is it about the Gold Coast that a professional team really struggles to make a foothold in the area?
Oh, it's such a good question. It's been asked year after year. I'm sure the government and the mayor would love, you know, an answer to it, because in my opinion, and from growing up there and obviously returning there for a couple of seasons to play professionally with Gold Coast United, sometimes I wonder if the lifestyle was actually too good, because there's so many things to do on the weekend or a Friday, Saturday night that professional sport, unfortunately, is one of the last, I guess, things that pop into people's minds. Yeah. They've had very good rugby league teams, even our Gold Coast United side the first season. Went half the season undefeated or something like that. And, you know, results were good and all those sorts of things. But then you drive to a game and, okay, it might be a very, you know, tourist heavy town during the summer. So a lot of tourists are just there for the lifestyle, and same with the locals. But, I just think it's a mix of, you know, there's so much to offer, so much competition that not even the rugby league or the AFL seem to really thrive there. So that's the only thing I can come up with, boys.
Yeah, it's a strange one. To go back to what you were saying before about when you started playing football and you said you fell in love particularly with being a goalkeeper, were you always a goalkeeper? Did you try out in other positions around the field? Did you have a go up front, or was it always, did you always kind of know that it was going to be goalkeeping that was the place that you loved playing?
Yeah, I think always in my heart it was goalkeeping. Up until 12, maybe the age of 12, you know, I'd like to have a run around with the other guys, and but it was just, there was something about being goalkeeper. It always dragged me back to, and you know, I'd have a bit of a run around, and then I'd ask to jump in goals, or you know, at training, I'd, you know, I just seemed to gravitate towards the goal mouth, and there was just something about the challenge of you know, waiting for someone to smash a ball at you and dive on it and or throw yourself in the way. Just something really appealed to me, and I think the fact that it doesn't and didn't back then, it doesn't appeal to a lot of kids at that age, purely from a fear factor or you know, just worried about taking the blame for goals and things like that. That there wasn't much competition, and if anything, I remember my coaches were glad to have me in there, and that's basically where I got my first shot at representative teams, because they needed goalkeepers. There was one good goalkeeper in my first year of age group representatives. I think it was under 16s, and I was selected as the second goalkeeper. And you know, it wasn't great. Firstly, I was, you know, I had no, I guess, personalized goalkeeping training up until the point of 16 or 17. And it was just going off that love for the position and maybe a bit of natural talent, throwing myself around and preferring to be on the ground more than on my feet. So I just fell into the position and kept at it until then.
So you signed for Sydney Olympic in 2002. And you ended up making three appearances in the NSL over the two seasons. How did the move to Sydney Olympic come about? And how much more patience does a goalkeeper require when you're young and not your first choice to be given a chance, unlike an outfield player? It seems when a goalkeeper gets a run of games and that they either stick with them or once the goalkeeper's form dips, that's when they look at changing people around. So it can be a long time for especially a young goalkeeper who's untried to get given that chance. How much patience compared to an outfield player do you need as a goalkeeper, and how much of an understanding did you have at the time that you needed to put your time in and wait for your opportunities to come around?
Yeah, good question. Look, firstly, I think goalkeeping is a position, is a sport, you know, in itself, really a sport inside a sport, because it's unlike anything else really in terms of the skills and certainly mindset, like you're speaking about to be successful at it. And I guess I solely played for the love of the game up until, like I said, 16 or 17, with still no real burning desire to, you know, go to Manchester United and have dreams like that. I was just really enjoying it at the time. And my final year of high school, I was at Palm Beach Crumb in a sports excellence program on the Gold Coast there. And I was fortunate enough, the head of football, Sam Wiseman, had actually typed up a CV for me, along with, I think, one of the other guys, and had sent it off to the NSL clubs at the time in Sydney. And I wasn't even aware of it, because again, it was something that I just wasn't pushing and chasing. I was just happy with what I was doing. And he came to me one day and said, look, I've sent off your CV. I think you've got a lot of talent and a lot of promise. And we've actually got a reply from Parramatta Power and Sydney Olympic, and they want you to go down and trial. And this is midway through grade 12. So it was kind of a difficult time, more than anything, to convince mum and dad to just pack up and leave midway through my final year of high school. So luckily, dad and I won that argument over mum. And next minute I know, I've kind of got a backpack and I'm going down to Sydney and trialing out at these two, probably the biggest clubs at the time. Parramatta Power were a new club, and it was Laurie McKinnon, I think, actually at the time was heading it up. Yeah, it was a long time ago now. And I had a little trial there, and also then I was shooting off across the other side of Sydney to trial with Sydney Olympic as well. And it just happened to be that Sydney Olympic were the first one to offer me a contract, and it was a 2-year youth team contract. And next minute I'm ringing mum and dad and saying, well, yeah, I'm not coming back to finish year 12 because they've given me this opportunity. And they said they'll put me out with a nice Greek family and look after me. And, you know, then I spent, I think it was 4 or 5 seasons there all together. And I learned so much under Clint Bolton, who was the, you know, the number one goalkeeper in the country at the time. And Jim Fraser, the goalkeeping coach, Frank Arrock was overseeing the academy kids. And it was just such a really, really nice feeling at that club. And in terms of being patient and waiting your chance, you know, I think Clint Bolton missed one game in his whole career. So there was definitely no chance of getting any game time ahead of him. And I think that was half the reason, looking back now, that the head coaches at Sydney Olympic, Branko Kalina, Gary Phillips, Lee Sterry, those guys were comfortable with me being a young number two at 17, 18, 19, because Clint Bolton was a guy you could rely on and through form and injury. So it was a great learning experience. Also learned to be patient. I learned a lot off Clint, and I'm really glad looking back now I had that development phase, because then any time through my career, whether it was through form or injury, that I was out of the position or on the bench or in the stands, it certainly helped me, and I could recall back on those times. And I've been third choice, second choice, first choice, through my career. And my advice to young keepers is always be prepared to handle all three of those positions, because it's the nature of the goalkeeping life cycle that you will start as a young goalkeeper on the bench or even a number three. Then you'll get onto the bench and then you have to wait to number one. And then you'll slowly drop back down, whether it's through form or injury, you'll drop to number two and then possibly number three. And, that's something that I was also really happy and enjoyed doing in my final year with the Jets, was supporting Luis Italiano as a second choice. And I could, offer any advice and guidance and just support to him, because I thought that was the best thing to do for the club and also for Luis, who I've known for so long.
To jump back to those early days, kind of around the start of the A-League, you signed for the New Zealand Knights, which was eventually an ill-fated club. But I think you were there for one season and made, was it 8 or 9 starts? Obviously as a backup keeper as well. What was it like being in a new setup in a new professional league, having played and been around the NSL through that transition into a new era of professional football? And what was it like being at that club up in Auckland that didn't get the best results, if you put it that way?
Well, I think that's probably the most difficult part of my career, to be honest, Patrick, because I think I played 3 or 4 games for Sydney Olympic and I just got a taste of it. I'd been a professional now for a couple of years, I felt, started feeling that real desire and hunger to become a number one and make a career in the game. And then all of a sudden the league just finishes and wraps up and there's no more NSL. And it's kind of like, oh, are you kidding me? Like now I know what I want to do. And I'm set up in a really nice spot here to pursue my dreams. And so when the A-League was announced and it was starting and each club would be, presented, all at different phases, different times. And I remember just sitting on the internet, and every time a club was announced or, shown on TV, I'd jump online, I'd find whatever name, whatever address, whatever contact I had, and I sent them all an email. And I actually showed Laurie McKinna and Ernie the email that I'd sent them as a young player to say, please, my name's Glenn Moss and I'm a goalkeeper and this is what I want to do. And I sent that to every A-League club at the time. And Laurie at Mariners, Ernie at Melbourne Victory were the only two that responded to say, sorry, we've already got goalkeepers signed. And New Zealand Knights were the third club, and they said that they were sending a scout over to watch the New South Wales and Victorian NPL games. And luckily at the time I was playing for Bonnie Regan, the New South Wales Premier League, and I got a tap on the shoulder after a game. And so they were from New Zealand Knights and interested and wanted me to come over. So, yeah, I was just rapt that I had that chance. And then when Danny Milosevic was signed as the first choice for New Zealand Knights, I was buzzing about that too, because he'd just come back from Leeds and had been the Ollie Roos keeper at the Sydney 2000 Olympics and was somebody that I'd watched and admired. So, to be a part of, like you said, a kind of a startup club that was very much on a low budget, and the A-League model right around the competition, I think there was still a lot of trial and error at all the clubs, and even though we won one game, it was that year to be with some of those top pros, Darren Baisley, Neil Emblem, Danny Hay, Danny Milosevic, you know, and I've got a few games there, I think, as well, mate, 5 or 6 games, something like that, first season. And despite the poor results, again, that was a big stage of my career. And even those games that I did get gave me, again, that belief that I could still go on and make a career in the game.
Just a question without notice, Glenn, obviously not having much to do with the New Zealand side of things, especially that early on, what was going wrong at the Knights at the time, and why do you think the Knights didn't work and the Phoenix so clearly has?
Well, I suppose it's easy with hindsight, mate. Looking back at it now, the players, there was no community engagement. I don't remember doing one promotion. I don't remember going to a school, a local club. I don't even, unfortunately, remember if there was a community officer employed at the club. Oh. So things like that now a massive part of professional sports clubs, not just A-League or football. It's something the Phoenix have done very, very well, something the Jets do really well. And that's where you really grow that supporter base, is from getting the players out into the community and schools, local clubs. There's no us versus them. It's you know, we're all one. We're all in the community together. And like I said, out of the clubs I've been at, Phoenix and the Jets probably do community the best. And I've really enjoyed doing it for both clubs as well, because I guess the easiest part of our job is to put a smile on a kid's face and have a kick and then see them come and watch you on the weekend.
I'll let you cover the rest of the New Zealand stuff, Patrick.
Cool. I mean, I don't think there's much more to talk about, because you're only there for a season, right? You ended up not having your contract renewed. Is that how it happened?
Yeah, it was a strange one. I had signed a 1-year deal. Like I said, I played a handful of games and thought I did quite well. And then whether they were unsure about the management for the following season, I can't recall, but there was no contract offered to me for the second season, and it was still a little bit wait and see. We'll have a chat to you at the end of the season. And there were all Whites games towards the end of that season. And unbelievably, one of them was against Brazil over in Geneva. And so I was lucky enough to play in that one and have a good game. And there was an agent waiting in the hotel lobby for me after the game, and he was the remaining agent that ended up offering me a contract at Dynamo Bucharest. So, you know, at the time there was nothing from New Zealand Knights the following year. And, I didn't actually return from that All Whites game. I went from Geneva into France to join Dynamo for pre-season training and ended up staying there for a season before coming back when the Phoenix were created.
Interesting that the Knights couldn't see their way clear to offer you a deal, and then a club over in Europe have decided to sap you up. But obviously, that you said that was how the transfer came about, to go into Romania. Obviously, the excitement levels from the beginning to the end were a little bit different. So at the beginning, how excited were you to be playing in Europe? For, I mean, Bucharest is a pretty well-known club around European circles. And about when did it sort of start to go sour for you? And because you tried to leave in the winter break, but you ended up staying out the rest of the season before coming back to Wellington. What was the timeline like from sort of beginning to end?
Probably, well, I guess misreported from saying, because it wasn't like that from memory, actually. I remember signing, obviously, and probably actually never being so scared in my life of anything, because it just came out of the blue from a dodgy agent that was sitting in a hotel lobby that I still didn't know whether he was for real or not, right up until the point of meeting someone from the club. So I was waiting for Ashton Kutcher or someone to jump out with a camera and tell, or, you know, Jeremy Christie and Dave Mulligan to jump out and say that they pranked me or something. But look, signing in Romania, what an amazing experience. Like you said, they were the biggest club in the country. We're in the UEFA Cup. Just the level from going to New Zealand Knights that didn't have a community officer, to going to Dynamo, where there's people there washing your car when you rock up, as a player, and there's always fans waiting for autographs every day at training. And it was a massive, massive step for me. And like I said, it was pretty scary, to be honest, at the start, because I was still quite young and hadn't played more than a handful of professional games. So there was certainly no expectation of walking in as a number one at a club that size. And it was only once we'd returned to Romania after the preseason in France that I realized there were four goalkeepers there at the time as well. So I thought, okay, well, fair enough. You know, that's why these clubs are so big, because there's four, if not five guys in every position. And I got the odd game here and there, cup games, things like that. And I'd actually intended to either stay there or continue on elsewhere in Europe, because there was some interest in Scotland as well.
Yep.
But when Ricky Herbert called and basically pitched the idea of the Wellington Phoenix, and his goal was to try and get as many New Zealand national team players back as possible. And the thought, when you're sitting in a freezing, snowing Romanian apartment, and you know, the idea of going back to Wellington and playing with some of your best mates, and being close to friends and family, and you know, the idea of being at a club that was going to be done right as well, after New Zealand Knights, and it was just too good to turn down. So that was the major reason for coming back, and it certainly wasn't for anything you know, horrible or you know, scary in Romania.
All right. Well, someone will need to adjust your Wikipedia page then. You're quoted as calling the move abroad a disaster, which was where I got most of that information
lost from. Lost in translation. I think it also says on Wikipedia I'm 6 foot four or something like that as well. So six they can adjust that while I'm there.
Yeah. You shrunk a couple of inches. So, yes.
at the moment. So you came back to Wellington and you got to experience forming a new New Zealand A-League club for a second time. You mentioned that it was nice to be part of something that was being done right. What were the big things that were the key moments that you realised that this was different to what had happened in Auckland the previous 2 years, and what made you decide that was probably going to be a good thing for the club?
Well, firstly, it would have been when the moment I arrived and Terry Serapisos took myself, Mick Ferrante and Vinny Lear out for dinner on Courtney Place. So that was the first time, three or four beers in, that I thought, gee, this place is going to be done right, because the passion that Terry had as an owner, the passion he had as a football person, the connections he had in Wellington at the time, the ideas were just, you could tell the way he believed in it and he spoke so passionately about it, that I thought, well, this already is a step in the right direction, since I'd never even met the owner of New Zealand Knights and didn't even know who it was at the time. So when the club owner picks you up and takes you to dinner, and I think he did that for most players, and you ask any of the boys that were there, and none of them have a bad word to say about Terry. If anything, we probably feel a little bit guilty, because I think we sent him bankrupt in the end. I remember the time he came into Cafe La Faria and asked, I think it was Jura and myself and Vinny or Siggy, that, hey, do you guys want me to get Beckham out here? And we kind of looked at him like, what do you mean, to play for us? And he laughed and said, no, I can get the Galaxy out and you can play against them. And we just went, oh, hell yeah, why not? And he said, right, leave it with me. And then, yeah, the next week he said, okay, I've had a chat to a few people and we're going to do it, but the only problem is you'll have to back up after playing Adelaide the night before. And we said, look, I don't think any of the boys will complain about having to back up. And you know, the game itself was amazing. The after party was even better. And, you know, it's a memory I'll keep forever.
Yeah, what was that night like? Because if my memory serves me correctly, that was the biggest crowd we'd had for football, certainly in Wellington, if not the country. And I think it's only been passed by the Newcastle playoffs a couple of years later. And it was pre-Bahrain as well. So it was one of the first times that we really packed it out. What was that night? What was the feeling in that stadium of someone who had grown up when football being, not football parents, being on the arches, to have that kind of game, that kind of crowd in little old New Zealand? Rugby mad New Zealand.
Yeah, it was awesome, mate. Like you're saying, it was probably one of the first big football games in the country, and the whole week leading up to it, that LA Galaxy had come out, and you know, we were trying to focus obviously on Adelaide in the A-League for the game the night before, but Ricky and the players, we were just getting questions about Beckham and It was Beckham Watch, and all the media were you know, stalking him outside of the Copthorne down at Oriental Parade, and you know, the boys were trying not to talk about it during the week, and I think even Adelaide had flown over a couple of days before the game, and you just wouldn't have even known they were there. But that game, the event, like I said, the media attention it got, I think it did wonders for the game, wonders for the Phoenix. You know, Beckham, what an absolute champion he was on and off the field. You know, he was just so warm and open. He came into our dressing room after the game because, of course, all the boys wanted to know right through the week is, oh, can we get some stuff signed? You know, mum and dad want this, and yeah. You know, my wife wants him to kiss her baby on the head and all this kind of stuff. And you know, the management at the time was like, look, you know, concentrate on the game. We'll do what we can do. And he was so good. He came in. I think he was probably still in his kit or a warm down kit or something, and just came into our dressing room with an assistant, and he just chatted with us. The guys would bring, you know, jerseys over, he'd sign it, he'd walk around taking photos with everybody. Even when they tried to usher him out and, you know, off to the next event, he was in no rush. He was just so accommodating, and he was like that for the after party as well, whether Terry had slipped him a bit of extra party money to stay or not, I don't know. But he was, I think, one of the last people to leave. It was awesome. So the whole event, I mean, people still talk about it, you know, years later.
Does my memory serve me correctly that he took a penalty in that game? Were you in goal for that pen?
Yes, he did take a penalty. No, I think Pasty was playing because I played the night before against Adelaide.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And I think that's how Ricky juggled the squad. Was he did play a lot of the reserve guys in the Galaxy game the next night. So yeah, he scored. I remember he had a free kick at the crossbar as well. And but it was just any time he got on the ball, it was a round of applause and cheering. And it was just really awesome kind of really. When they talk about friendly matches, that's one I think back in my career and go, that was a proper friendly because it was just an exhibition match.
Remember who got his jersey?
Who got his jersey?
Yeah. I think there would have been no shortage of people going up to him asking to swap.
Well, there nobody did because Ross Aloisi had already asked him and grabbed it off him, I think. They did a promotion the day before or a couple of days before. They did some media promotion and Ross came into training that day and said, don't even bother asking for his jersey, boys, because I've just, you know, had a chat to him at the captain's press conference and I've already got it. So nobody even got a chance.
You got to be in quick. The rest of that time, that couple of years, I think the first season you started quite a lot of it because Pasty was injured at first, and the second season a bit less game time. How was that in kind of being heavily involved and then not as involved for a second season?
Yeah, it was pretty much like that, mate. I'd signed as number two. Ricky was honest about that. And again, coming back from Romania, I had no issues. And Pasty was the national team number one and the senior keeper as well. So it was only until the captain's run the day before the first game that Pasty had suffered concussion and got kicked in the head that I started that season at all. So I think, he missed maybe two or three games with the concussion. And I'd expected, to be honest, you know, Pasty to come back in. And Ricky had a chat to me during the week and said, look, you've been playing well the first couple of games. I'll keep you in there and you'll stay there as long as you keep playing well. And I think I did go on to play every game bar one that season and had a really good season. So that's why probably halfway through the next season, Melbourne Victory contacted me and said that Michael Theo was heading off overseas and they needed another goalkeeper. So I'd taken that opportunity. And at the time I was, I'm not sure if I was in the squad for the Phoenix or out of it, but you know, when you tell a club that you're obviously leaving, you don't expect to be, you know, getting many favors for the rest of that season anyway.
I mean, let's talk about Melbourne Victory. You signed for them, and I think you signed for them just after the Confeds Cup. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, I'd signed for Victory midway through the season with the Phoenix.
Gotcha.
I must have been maybe just into the new year, January, December, January, something like that. And then at the end of that season in May was, or June, sorry, was the Confederations Cup. So I'd already moved to Melbourne prior to the Confederations Cup in South Africa in 2009. And I was fortunate enough to play all three games at the Confederations Cup. And, you know, that was an amazing tournament playing against Spain, South Africa, Iran, and then went from there to begin with Melbourne. And look, in terms of the facilities, the professionalism, the way the club operated, it was, you know, it was exactly why I went there, is to, you know, experience again a you know, different club in a bigger city. They were obviously so successful at the time, having won the grand final the year before, the 5 or 6-1, I think it was. And it was a really, I guess, exciting time at that stage of my career. And look, it's one I thoroughly enjoyed and don't have any regrets at all. And if anything, that was where I was introduced to Ernie Merrick, and we formed such a close relationship. And, you know, people, I guess, think just because I only stayed there one season and left and didn't play much, that there was, you know, nothing good about it. But you know, I've played with Ernie at two clubs after that, and you know, if I hadn't have had that time with him at Victory, I don't think we would have had that relationship. And you know, he's, I guess, one of the closest you know, relationships I've had with a manager through my career.
There was interest overseas after your performances at the Confed Cup. Apparently there were some South African clubs that were interested in signing you. Has there been sort of steady interest over the course of your career from overseas clubs? And how close did you actually come to not going to Melbourne and looking at looking to try your luck overseas again? Or were you sort of, you'd sort of made the decision you were keen to stay in Australia / New Zealand and stay in the A-League? What was how much of the tossing up between staying local or moving overseas has there been throughout your career?
Well, unfortunately in football, I've never got to choose when the opportunities come along, and all my opportunities came along at the wrong time. So I'd already signed for Wellington Phoenix when there was interest from Scotland, and then I'd already signed for Melbourne Victory prior to the Confederations Cup, where there was interest from South African clubs after that. And then there was, towards the end of my career, offers in Asia after I just had my second child. So there was, you know, at all those moments, it wasn't right for me. Or even possible to explore those options. So I had a trial at Sheffield United after my first season at Gold Coast, and that was probably the best opportunity I had. And I went over there and trialed for a week, week and a half before going away to China with the national team. And I trained well, but I couldn't play. And the manager said that he wanted me to return after the game in China with the national team. But then while I was away, he got sacked. So, you know, the nature of British football, the way it is, that's how that happened. And, look, I wouldn't have said honestly that I was better than the goalkeepers they had anyway. I was on par with them and then fitted in. But if you're trolling overseas, unless you're a lot better than what they have, then you can't expect them to bend over backwards and sign you anyway. So, look, I enjoyed my season in Romania in terms of overseas football. And look, at the end of the day, I've had a 20-year professional career. And would you rather a 20-year professional career in Australia and New Zealand, or a 2-year professional career in the UK? And then that's it. So, and that's, you know, happened to a couple of my mates, and they've had a few years overseas and then come back and can't even get an A-League club. So, look, I suppose while I didn't have dreams to play for Manchester United, my dreams were to become a professional footballer and have a career in the game, which I've been lucky enough to have.
One of the probably best best seasons you had in that career was probably that first year at Gold Coast United, where high-flying, and was it you made the playoffs that year? What was it about the setup there at, again, another pretty new club? I think, was that the first year of Gold Coast United? But what was it like at that club that allowed you to kind of have...
The second year, I think Mossy came in for Jess Van Stratten.
There we go, Fern's onto it. But yeah, what was it like in that setup that allowed you to thrive and play well?
Yeah, well, probably the fact that Gold Coast was where I grew up. So mum and dad were still there. My friends, family were still there. I knew all the local clubs, the area, a lot of the football people, and it just it felt a very comfortable environment. And that, along with the squad that we had at the time, was phenomenal. Jason Kalina, Smeltsy, Bruce Jute, Dino Djulbic, Adama Traore. It was a loaded squad, and you know, we had a pretty eccentric owner in Clive Palmer, but he backed us to the hills, and you know, gave the team private jets and all those things.
We'll get to him in a minute.
Well, as I said, you'll have to charge the batteries and the microphone for some of those stories, because there's so many. But personally, it was being around, you know, top guys, good pros, they're winners, along with some of my best mates. Scott Higgins was the number two, or I guess my backup goalkeeper, but he was also my goalkeeping coach at the time as well. So that was a really unique relationship, and one that worked really well. And you know, look, we just had a team there that was could be so successful, and we did lose the knockout semi to the Central Coast, who went on to, I think, losing penalties to Brisbane Roar in the final.
Ah, yes, memories. So obviously during this time, like we mentioned, you had all this circus going on around Clive Palmer. Well, how much contact did you have with, it sounds like you did have a bit of contact with Clive. It wasn't working, for instance, similar parallels to around the Nathan Tinkler time, where no one really saw Nathan. It was all through Troy Palmer and the people around the Jets office. But sounds like Clive was very hands-on with you guys. So how much contact did you guys have with him throughout the course of while you were there? And he did spend a lot of money, and they did everything right at the club, getting a strong team and putting all the money behind it. But it seemed most of the destabilisation that took place was firmly centred around Clive and his battles with FFA, the stadium, Queensland government, tea ladies, whoever he could pick a fight with. So that seemed to have been the main impetus for the club actually folding after you've been there for two seasons. So what's sort of the timeline there? How much positivity was there when you came in, and then what was it like as it headed towards the inevitable end, as it were?
Well, look, firstly, yeah, Clive was very, very hands-on. He loved us. He would create space at his Avica Lodge that was essentially a golf course, and where he ran all his business, the business side of things from. And we'd use that space for a gym and our recovery sessions and the pool, and there were tennis courts there. And he'd always be there. He loved us. He was hands-on. He'd say things to us like, if Frank Lowy had got rid of this idea of a salary cap, I'd pay you blokes what you're worth. And, you know, that was, I guess, his passion, or his initial passion anyway. And I think, you know, Clive was, I guess, a little bit misunderstood as well, because we're talking about a very successful businessman that is being restricted in how he can run a business. And that's not something that he'd ever experienced before. So when he wanted to run his business in a certain way and was being told he couldn't, then he's not the type that would just put his hand up and say, okay, no worries. Well, you know, here's the check. I'll just do what you want. No, he believed in freedom of speech and would believe in making our competition a better league. And he had all the very best intentions. But unfortunately, it turned out to be a bit of a personal battle, I think, with Frank Lowy at the time. And in the end, his license, I believe, was taken off him. It wasn't handed back or anything like that. But it was a bit of a shame, because, you know, as crazy as it sounds, we need, and especially looking at the league now, we need people like that with pockets that full to help us, because at the moment our game is financially struggling severely. So instead of going to war with these very successful, financially strong people, we should be doing business with them and help you know, getting their help. And Clive wanted to build a stadium, a purpose-built private football stadium for us on the Gold Coast. Like I said, the travel, flying around in private jets, all those kind of things showed his intentions. And unfortunately, it didn't end that way. And again, you talk about other owners at the time struggling financially, going missing and hiding, you know, not being front and center, then you certainly couldn't say that about Clive.
The impression I'm getting from you is that he might have actually been a really successful owner in the current A-League in terms of the independent A-League and the clubs having a bit more say. It almost seems like he would thrive under this environment if he'd been able to drag the A-League out. Would you agree with that?
Well, obviously, being in the players' bubble, there's a lot that we don't know about. All I can tell you is that when owners or chairmen, you know, come in and address players, or how much time they spend with them, whether it's Terry Serapisos taking every new player out to dinner and a beer when they sign, or Clive Palmer wanting to, you know, allocate one of his own private jets for his football team that make him absolutely $0 each year and just cost him millions, but they're still willing to go out and do things like that, then all I can say is their intentions are in the right place. Mm. When it gets to a board table or a meeting room at the higher level, obviously I've got no idea what goes on behind totally. The scenes.
Yeah.
But as a player, when you have an owner saying to you, you know, we want to pay you more, we want bigger crowds, we want better things, we want private facilities, but I can't do it, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's the federation or the government, then that just leaves you scratching your head, really.
So you had a really good 2010-2011 season, that first season you were there. Unfortunately, the second season, you did really well up until getting injured. You spent, I think, half a season on the injury table. How was that something you had to deal with previously? How difficult is it for goalkeepers, especially with taking, you know, if you have a short-term injury, it's something you can bounce back from pretty quickly, but you were missing for half a season there and you've been performing really well as the number one. How difficult is that whole long-term injury recovery and how had you actually had to deal with that before?
Well, being injured on the Gold Coast for Christmas and New Year in a Surfers Paradise apartment, 19 floors up, looking out over the ocean, isn't probably the worst place to do a rehab. But I understand the question. So it was actually 12 months. I'd snapped my adductor muscle clean off the bone, taking a pretty standard goal kick at a game against Adelaide, you know, 7 or 8 rounds into the season. And it had just come completely off the bone and gone. And I needed to get it reattached. And it was 12 months until I could kick a ball again. So, and then while that was happening, it wasn't just the champagne bottles over New Year's on the Gold Coast, but then that's when the Gold Coast collapsed and the license was taken off them that season.
Well, so
trying to find myself a club while I'm midway through a pretty serious injury wasn't an ideal situation. And look, I was just fortunate at the time that the Phoenix were going through keeper struggles at the time. Pasty was injured and they'd gone through a couple of goalkeepers. I think Tony Warner was heading back to the UK. Yeah. Reece Crowther was heading over to Australia. And, you know, Pasty was coming back from injury. So to get a call from Ricky and ask how my injury was at the time, I thought it was just you know, Ricky being the standard nice guy he was. But then at the end of it, when he said, do you think you'll be right to come and play for us next season? I kind of sat a little bit higher on my crutches and went, yeah, I'll be fine. Just don't ask for a medical test, you know, in the next 3 months. But I'll sign on the dotted line and I signed a 3-year contract. And, I feel that was probably the best 3 seasons or maybe 2 seasons once Pasty had retired of my career.
I think that first year you were back at the Phoenix was Ricky's last year in charge of the club. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah. Correct. So my first season, Pasty was number one and Ricky was still there. And towards the end of the season, results were poor. And Ricky had been stood down and Greeny had taken over.
Yep.
Was it at that time just on his own for the rest of the season?
Yep.
Before Ernie obviously came in the following year.
So it's been talked about a lot about the Ricky way of things and the reasons why it fell apart. I don't want to go into too much detail with you, but what was there a difference in the way that you felt Ricky was coaching compared to a few seasons earlier when things were a bit different at the club? Or was it just that the A-League had become more technical and faster and Ricky's tactics weren't quite up to that new football anymore?
Yeah, it's hard to recall at the time, mate. I don't think it was a case of Ricky or the Phoenix being left behind. Mm. I'm not sure if, our squad at the time was the strongest either. Obviously, when Ernie came in the following year, he brought Carlos Hernandez, Nathan Burns, those sorts of players. And, that's the reason we had the success in getting to the finals that we did with Ernie. I mean, obviously Ernie's, he's an attacking minded coach and, it was very hard for me and especially the defenders to accept that this is a coach that doesn't mind conceding three goals so long as we score four, which is something you want to get a lot around football anywhere in the world with managers and, I guess their job security and things like that. But, only had this belief in us and, everywhere he's gone, he did the same thing at Newcastle Jets when he came here and, got 10 or 11 goals out of Jason Hoffman the first year he was here and Andrew Naboo coming back from the jungles of Borneo and these sorts of guys. So, look, it was just a fresh face. Ricky had probably been there a long time as well. It was hard for me to say because I had left and come back. But,
of course,
the boys really kind of resonated with Ernie when he came in and, that was why we had the success we did.
Let's talk about that 2014-15 season, and I promise Ferns will move on to the Jets after this. but that season,
he's still there.
I'm still here.
that season, Nathan Burns came in, and I think it's one of the most successful seasons the Phoenix have had in the history. I think it is. What was it like playing for a team back in Wellington at a club you've been with a bunch of friends, where you were flying high? I think we led the league at one point that season. What was that time at the club like?
We were leading the league into January.
Asian Cup happened, didn't it?
Asian Cup came along.
Yeah.
And we obviously the league stopped for 4 or 5 weeks while the Asian Cup was on in Australia. And then the league resumed in February and Burnsy couldn't score a goal. And no one else, I think at the time, had expected that they might have to chip in because at that stage, it was just give the ball to Burnsy, the guy's on fire, and he'll score. And then, for whatever reason, it was harder for Burnsy to score. And then the rest of the boys were trying to chip in, and we kind of went from top of the league to limping in, maybe at third place or fourth place, something like that. And then getting knocked out in the first round of the finals at home to Melbourne Heart. I think they were still at the time Melbourne Heart or Melbourne City. We got knocked out and we didn't even get a shot on target in that game. And it was crazy. I remember being in the dressing room after that game and I think Jason Piney was, he waited for me and I didn't even expect him to still be there. I was just walking out of the ground because I had taken that long. I was gutted. And he just kind of stayed and he gave me a hug firstly. And he said, look, I wanted to just stay and give you a hug because I can only imagine how that feels. But can I ask you a few questions for radio while you're here? And I've kind of never been so speechless in my life because I remember saying to him something like, Piney, I'd rather have had a rubbish season and somehow scraped into the finals or into a grand final and not really deserve to be there than flying, being top of the league at January and then going out with not even having a shot on target in a home semi. It's just a really empty, sickening feeling. And everyone was just kind of speechless. And I don't remember a Mad Monday or any sort of gathering afterwards because no one could really believe how that season had finished. It was just really, really dark. And, we just felt like we let so many people down because we were flying and, we'd silenced everyone in Australia that was questioning the Phoenix's existence and their right to have a license and those sorts of things. That we had expected so much more out of ourselves than what ended up happening.
Yeah, and then eventually Ernie left the Phoenix and moved to the Jets, and I'll let Ferns take over from here.
All right. Well, obviously, Mossy, you became Ernie's first signing in May of 2017. So what's it about that relationship? You said you've worked with him over three different clubs. What is it about the way Ernie plays, the relationship you have with him? What is it that makes you want to work under him?
I think, that was the first time I'd retired. So I'd wrapped things up with the Phoenix because they were in between managers and said that they were waiting to appoint a manager before they would sign anyone for the following season. And again, I think that was my fifth season after, you know, being back there, my second stint. And I'd opened a cafe back in Sydney with my brother-in-law that I was a silent partner with. And I thought, well, this is probably a good time to wrap it up and go back to work in the cafe, which we did. And, you know, I was elbow deep in a sink full of dirty coffee cups. And I had a missed call from Joel Griffiths, and we'd played together in Wellington before he'd hurt his knee and finished his career. And I rang him back at the end of the shift and said, what do you want? Do you want a free coffee or something? And he said, no, I don't want a free coffee. I want to offer you a job. And I was like, oh, here we go. I said, mate, I'm retired and I'm, you know, got elbow deep in a sink here. And he said, well, Ben Kennedy's just told us that he's leaving and we need a goalkeeper. He said, mate, I can't guarantee it'll be number one because Jack Duncan's here, but, you know, I'm just trying to find out who's available at the moment. And I said, oh, look, you know, I've kind of just told my wife and my brother-in-law that we're moving on and, you know, retiring and getting into the next phase of life. So let me have a think about it. And then the next call I got was from Ernie Merrick saying, look, if it helps at all, I'm going to come in as well and be the manager. I'd love you to come. So that along with, you know, only a two-hour drive from Sydney to Newcastle really sealed it for me because I knew what Ernie would bring to the squad, the club, the brand of football, how he would manage the players. And I guess in terms of your question on what, you know, works for Ernie, it's the fact that he is certainly a manager that puts the person first and the player second. And I think, you know, the way the world is at the moment, it's something that's I guess rare. You know, that we have to remember that, you know, we're all humans, we're all people. And if you're just going to treat somebody by a job title or a jersey number and those sorts of things, you know, we're going to have big problems. So the fact that he had always treated me personally and my teammates in Wellington as, you know, people first. And if our kids were sick or things like that, you know, he'd always give us the time off, and just the way he came in, freshened things up, and then released the shackles on the boys. And like I said, he threw Hoffy up front or out wide and brought in Andrew Naboo. You know, we obviously all knew what type of player Dimmy was, and just said, go for it, boys. I don't mind if you concede three so long as you score four. And it really resonated with that group of players.
You know, the Kevin Keegan method of games. But, I mean, the Jets have been struggling for years, so it had to have been had to have given you pause for a minute to come into a club that's not one of those big city clubs that can spend some more money and then improve their fortunes. It's got to be a whole of club approach, which the Jets have not been renowned for in previous seasons. So that had to have given you a little bit of make you a little bit cautious. And then to see the turnaround that Ernie did bring in that first season of his, was that even above and beyond the players' expectations? Because I remember sitting down with him at some point during that season, I think it might have been very early on, where we sort of said, you know, how do you think this season's going to turn out? And he was very bullish, as he always was, even when we weren't performing that well, he was still very positive about the team. But it was very sticks in my memory that he was, well, the players, they want to make finals and they want to go all the way through, and I think we've got the players to do that. Was that the mentality around the team, and how much of that was the driving force behind such a fantastic, like, it's one of the best seasons we've had apart from the season we actually won it, of course.
Yeah, well, I suppose that I wasn't hesitant in signing that season, as funny as it sounds, because they did finish, I think, Wooden Spoon the year before and
yep.
and had a pretty bad season. But for me, it was also, Ernie was quite honest and said, look, I do have Jack Duncan here who, you know, is one of the most talented up-and-coming goalkeepers in the competition, but I need a experienced goalkeeper to support him and work with him. So I signed as the number two, as the backup keeper. And I think having that purpose for me was, you know, one of the best things that's happened to me, because it's where I've discovered my love for coaching as well. So coming there and support Jack, an ambitious, talented young goalkeeper, and then to join in with the group of top pros that we had at the time under a manager that just gave the boys so much freedom to play. It was just the perfect mix, I think, for that season. You've got Laurie McKinnon and Joel Griffiths in management positions at the club, and they're football people. And that's another key, you know, to that season especially, was that when Laurie needed to make the change in the squad in terms of management, he obviously made the right decision. He, you know, other clubs that don't have football, I guess, staff with football backgrounds, making those decisions, it's a lot more difficult for them to get the feeling on the ground what the players need. And Laurie just nailed it, bringing Ernie and the whole atmosphere. And, you know, I didn't know what it was like before I'd come, but, you know, midway through preseason, I've got senior players coming to me saying, hey, this is good, huh? Like, you know, is this what it's been like in the past? And, you know, they were really enjoying it. So when players are enjoying coming to training every day, there's nowhere else they want to be. Those sorts of feelings show on the weekend. And then as the crowd started to build, that's when the belief started to build. And like you said, preseason, I think we're probably aiming for finals, you know, like most clubs do, without putting too much pressure to finish any higher. But then when we're jumping back and forth through the season, we thought, hey, we can really do something special. And then to host a grand final, I think, was beyond anyone's dreams.
So you had a 9-run game in that season when Jack got injured. Obviously, you said you were signed as a second keeper. Were you expecting when he came back from injury that maybe you would be given a little bit more of a chance, or you were happy to fill in while he was injured and then take that step back and keep as the second keeper? How much competition was there for that first keeper spot?
I had fractured ribs at the time. I was getting injections in my ribs, so I was begging. I've never begged in my career more to please don't select me. As soon as Jack could, I think, strap up his ankle or his toe that he'd hurt, and was good enough to take a goal kick to halfway, I've never been so happy in my life. So, look, that role, like I said, that was my purpose, to support Jack, and then if needed, do a job. You know, until he returns. So, that I was more than happy with the handful of games I got, because then at the end of the season, obviously Jack went down again in the semi-final, and, next minute I'm lining up in a grand final. So I've got no complaints with the way that season turned out.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously we've got an entire podcast series you may or may not have heard, about the 2008, grand final season. And the players were absolutely amazed at the way the town got behind, and again that happened in this season, where we had the grand final and we were hosting it, didn't get taken off us and stuck down in Sydney. So what are your memories of that week leading up to the grand final, and what are your memories of the build up before the game and basically everything before the 9th minute of the match, where a certain header that we'll get to in a second?
Yeah, look, what an awesome week. It was special for me because just the way the season had turned out, my role, my mindset, coming out of my first retirement, I have two kids. My wife's family were all a two-hour drive away. So to have everyone there at that stage of my life, you know, have the kids come to the family day,
training session before the grand final. It was really, really special, and you could really feel how much it meant to the people of Newcastle. And like I said, I haven't been in the city long, in the town long, and to have supporters telling me that they'd been there since day one and gone through all the rough years, all the good years, and just stuck with this team, this club, through the change of ownerships, through everything. It was just such a great time to be in this city, and it's just such a shame that we couldn't have pulled it off. And look, for whatever reason, in the ninth minute it happened, and you know, that's just how it worked. But I mean, even not forgetting Riley's freakish goal the game before with the scorpion kick to actually get us in the final. I mean, you can't write stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Were there, just going back to the day leading up to the match, what did that look like? I know there are some stories around the 2008 grand final where players had a team meeting and they spoke about what it meant to be playing in a grand final. Some of the local players talked about what it meant to the town and meant to the team. Any sort of similar things take place in the lead up to this grand final? Any interesting stories before kickoff?
No. And knowing Ernie, it was very much just keep it as is. The reason we'd got to the final in the first place was because we were doing things that were working. So I actually think, if anything, we were protected a little bit, which was good to know and good to feel at the time. I think even the powers that be wanted us to drive from our homes on match day out to the university and get on the team bus and then take the bus into the stadium just so Foxtel could get a shot of us getting off the bus together or something like that. And luckily enough for us, between Ernie and Laurie and Joel, they squashed things like that, and we rocked up in our cars to a grand final just like any other game. And it was, besides the open family day at the final training session, which was actually really nice because, as I said, the boys got to have their kids on the field, and their partners and their families come down and join in with the supporters. To say thank you, not just the supporters, but our families that are supporters through the season and stuck by us as well, was really nice. So while there wasn't any need for massive motivational talks and things like that, it was more of a case of let's just enjoy it and not put any pressure on ourselves, because we hadn't done from pre-season that season, and it got us to a final.
Yep, absolutely. Well, I don't really want to talk over too much of about that game for obvious reasons, but how clearly were the three or five players of the Melbourne Victory offside when that header from James Donaghy, who's quite interested, I don't know if Patrick's aware of this, but we've announced that we've signed him for next season, so that's an interesting bit of banter that's going to take place when he walks in the changing rooms for the first time. But
that's some of Laurie McKinnon's best work.
yeah, absolutely. But could you see it was a clear offside from where you were before Barbarossa got to the ball and put it away?
Well, no, because I don't know if you were at the ground at the time, but the screen's cut out as well. They didn't show any replays, so. Obviously, it was a set piece. So, like everyone else, I was, you know, watching the ball being delivered from out wide. So, you know, none of us really. I don't even think anyone appealed for an offside at the time.
That would be my next question: were there any other players sort of like saying, "Hey, these guys were offside"? But did anybody from the team?
Yeah, well, I mean, Donks was at the back post as well. So he was essentially the furthest player and behind everyone else, which you could argue is another reason, with the brightest bleach blonde hair that you'd ever seen and the only one on the field at the time, standing probably 10 to 15 meters in front of the linesman. It was a strange one for it not to be picked up at the time by the officials. But, you know, that's, I guess, an argument for another day, and how that they have would appear to be reliant on video technology because it's available. But then when the video technology isn't working, then who do we rely on from then? Because at the time, even the ref the referees were saying, "Oh, just wait," and then he kept, you know, holding his ear. So we were presuming that it was being checked, but they don't show it on the big screen, otherwise there would be riots. And so everyone's just standing around, and the ref just at the time said, "No, it's been checked, boys. It's, you know, it's kind of all good." And so we didn't appeal. We just assumed that everyone at home was getting to watch replays back over and over, and they'll come to a decision. So it wasn't until we had actually gotten into the change rooms afterwards that some of the family and that were coming to the dressing rooms, and boys were checking their phones, that they're like, "Hey, have you seen the goal?" And yeah, the change room kind of just went silent while everyone was either looking at footage or listening to somebody that had seen it at the time. And it was just really strange, but no, we didn't know at the time, obviously. And look, we, regardless of how that goal happened, we still had enough chances in that game and played well enough to win it. But you know, credit to Melbourne, they hung on and literally threw their bodies on the line to get that win.
And faces in the way and all sorts of things. Yeah. Look, and just let me say on behalf of the supporters, thanks for an absolutely fantastic season. Obviously, it's not something that we want to. We like to remember a great deal losing a grand final in that manner, but everything leading up to that was just completely special, and you played no small role in that. So thanks very much. Mm. So obviously Duncan left the club after the grand final to go and play in Saudi Arabia, I think. And then you were obviously made the number one keeper with, I think that's when Italiano came in. So you had another really standout season, 22 out of 27 games, achieving the second highest save percentage in the league that season, but clearly in a team that was struggling for goals and struggling for wins to back up what took place the previous season. How do you balance, obviously you feel like you're performing well and doing what you are required to do, and the other players in the team are struggling for form and struggling to score, and the wins aren't coming. How do you handle balancing that?
I handled it a lot better towards the end of my career, I guess, like you'd expect with most things. When you're a young player and you're, I guess, performing well, but your teammates or the team isn't, you probably do get a bit carried away with yourself without even realizing. But that's, again, the nature of the position. When your team, I guess, aren't performing well, then that's your job as a goalkeeper, that you then have to perform well because you're in the thick of the action. And if you can keep your team in the game long enough, then maybe you'll get a goal down the other end and win the game. So I've really enjoyed those seasons and those games, I guess, because that's what we train for. That's our position. That's what we're there to do. So look, I wouldn't be there if I didn't enjoy being under pressure and having that responsibility of the number one. That's, again, something difficult for young keepers to grasp straight away, because you only learn that over time. And look, it's difficult to be humble, I guess, because especially with the way social media and the mainstream media are these days, that, you know, that you're either focusing on scoring goals or saving goals in our match. The parts in between don't get too much attention. So, but at the end of the day, I've always said that I'd rather have a stinker and win the game than a blinder and lose the game, because it just changes the whole atmosphere of the team getting the win, and your job's a lot more pleasant for the next 5 or 6 days before the next game if you get the win, no matter how it is.
Yeah, absolutely. So you played at the end of that season Champions League again. We ended up with a battling win against Jakarta and then a loss to the Kashima Antlers. What were your memories and thoughts around those two games? The Kashima one was especially interesting to watch. The J-League sides are just clearly a step or two above where most of the A-League teams are at this current point in time. How did you find those two games and just the standard of play from Kashima especially? I just was sitting there watching them going, look, these guys are clearly a really beautiful team to watch. What was it like being in the thick of that?
Well, I have to be honest, I think there were moments of the game where I was thinking exactly the same thing as you, just saying, wow, the way these guys pass the ball, the move, the accuracy, how they know their roles, they know each other's roles out there. It's clockwork. And it's funny because the simple things like the way they take their first touch, they're always looking forward, the technique on the pass, the accuracy, that's what they've been learning over there from the age of 4, 5, 6. And it's probably goes to show more so, I guess, the how far we are in terms of developing younger players over here, because they're not so much working on things like technique at that level. You know, they're being managed by a Brazilian coach on how to win a game. He expects their technique to be sorted, and I can kind of understand at the professional level, that shouldn't be something that a professional coach is worried about, the accuracy of a player's pass or first touch and his movement, those sorts of things. So, look, I'm no stranger to Japanese football. I've played against the Japanese national side, the age group side with New Zealand as well. And every time we've come up against them, it's the same story. They just, you can't get the ball off them, and they work their way up the field to the point where you don't know whether they're going to score a 20-yard screamer or just walk the ball in around you. So, look, the way Japanese football has come on since probably the year they hosted the World Cup, you know, they've done some really great work over there.
I do realize this has been a long stretch of Jets questions, but this is the last Jets specific one, and we'll see if Patrick's got any questions with regards to the All Whites. But the current season with Ernie, been a bit of a struggle. Obviously, he ended up getting sacked partway through the season. Deansy took over for a spot before Carl Robinson came in. There's been a remarkable turnaround since Ernie was moved on. I'm pretty sure when I spoke to Laurie, he said that, and I also spoke to Carl as well, they both said that he was providing some advice before he actually landed in the country and officially took over the team. What have you found the differences between the two coaches, and why do you think Carl's sort of done what Ernie did when he first joined, put a breath of fresh air through the club and changed some things around? What's been the differences to what Carl's done over what Ernie was experiencing?
Oh, gee, it's a tough question, because I mean, firstly, every manager is different, and that's not for the wrong reasons or negative reasons. So as you'll notice, Carl, his philosophy is a lot different. The way he wants to play, building up from the back, keeping the ball, having faith and trust and belief in the players to keep possession of the ball. You know, he's happy with, or will expect, understand players to make mistakes, and he doesn't mind that if we're being brave and you know, playing the way he wants to play, because he believes that we can keep possession and build up from the back and work our way forward from there. And you know, then be ruthless down the other end. So, look, he's brought that in, and I think the players have really enjoyed that. Yeah, look, besides Topper scoring worldies from 40 yards out, him and Bogues are still players that love to have the ball at their feet. They've got no issue with that. So, I guess he's just seen different strengths in the players that we have. And look, we had to try something different, something new, and this has worked really well. Again, another fantastic person as well. Played at the highest level himself, internationally and professionally. He's brought in assistant Kenny Miller, who, you know, whether you like Rangers or Celtic or not, he's an absolute legend of a player, top guy. You know, will be the last man out in the training field, working with the boys, finishing, shooting, and not just the starting players, but the, you know, the scholarship players. It doesn't matter who you are, how big you are. You know, everyone gets treated equally, and the players have really enjoyed that time. And it's such a shame that we had to have the break that we had, because we were just getting on a little roll there, and I felt my cameo of 7 minutes was good enough to keep my spot for the next week.
Hopefully that carries over.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk a little about the All Whites then, because that was obviously a big part of your career, especially through kind of that middle half of what you were doing. Let's talk about the 2010 World Cup. Obviously, probably tinged with a little bit of disappointment for you not being able to actually play at the World Cup itself. You played qualifiers, and I don't know. I'm not sure if any of the Jetstream listeners are aware, but there was a red card that is somewhat dubious issued in that qualifier, and a lack of appeal from New Zealand Football due to administrative error. How difficult was it as a player who's getting to represent his country at the highest level to have what every kid dreams of, playing in the World Cup, kind of taken from you by such farcical means?
Wow, what a great question to finish up, guys. And it's not just because I've got two kids banging the door down, wanting to go out and have a kick, but
answer it quickly.
Again, it's I was only joking. It's a it is a good one because, again, looking back at it now, I don't feel like I've missed out on anything. And as strange as that sounds, if you were a part of our group in 2010 that went to the World Cup and you were in that FIFA bubble that we like to call it, where you're just treated like rock stars from the minute you leave your front door in New Zealand to the minute you return, police escorts and business class travel and just everything laid on for you. And then you've got the performances and results at the World Cup, going undefeated, which was crazy enough, and having the Italian media writing headlines that it was going to be a national day of mourning in Italy because, a Puma rep, a school teacher and a banker from New Zealand held Italy to a 1-1 draw, and that, you know, they were actually lucky to get that penalty and a draw in the first place. So that was an amazing experience, and it was I think a couple of months there, about 2 months in total, the tour. And you know, we had so many things going on around the group as well, and Ben Sigmund's young boy Cam had just been born prematurely, Siggy decided to, you know, join the group late, but still come, and you know, just that brotherhood, that bond that we had that we had, and a lot of us were, you know, we come up through the age groups together as well, so we'd known each other for a long time. Ricky was an Phoenix coach as well, and there was just, you know, it goes to show that you can have all the superstars, I guess, in the world. A team of individuals will never beat, you know, a team of brothers like that. And that's essentially what we were. And we were well aware of who we were coming up against on the stage that we were playing on. But we backed each other. We loved each other so much that's what got us the results. We did it at the end of the day. I don't even remember how half the games, you know, went, or the style formation, how we played. It just, you know, it's not part of the memories that we took away. It was the time we spent together, the accommodation, the decisions that, you know, every other team stayed in a hotel for the World Cup, and I think it was such a long tour to be in a hotel. As nice as they are, they can just get boring and dull. And we were lucky enough that we were staying on a golf course in a cul-de-sac of five or six houses that there are some families kind enough to vacate for us. And we moved into these houses that still had family portraits on the wall, the kids, dinner plates in the sink, and we just felt like we were at home, essentially living with five of the boys. And it just worked for us. And the whole issue around my receiving a red card in the final qualifying game and not being eligible for the World Cup. But the type of person Ricky was like, I'm still taking you anyway. I'm lucky enough to take three goalkeepers, and I don't plan on using all three of you. So I still need you. You've been in this build up, this World Cup cycle from the start, and played most of the qualifiers, and the workload, as I said, the 2 months tour as well. We needed everybody at that time. And, it was a crazy thing to think that, yeah, the Westpac banker and the Puma rep and school teacher, you know, went toe to toe with the Italians and came away with a point.
It was incredible. I think it was almost exactly 10 years ago at the moment as well, which time flies, right?
Oh, reunion, is that what you're saying?
Well, maybe. Let's give it a go, eh?
I'll get onto the party boys.
Yeah, yes. Anyway, let's go. Let's do the Jetstream 10. We'll round out with that, eh, Ferns?
All right. Cool. Yep, no problems. So feel free. When you come to the Jets, you have to get up in front of everybody and sing a song. So what was yours, Mossy, when you got up? And from all the people you've seen get up and sing a song, who had the best or worst renditions?
Oh, lovely question. Mine would have been probably Chili Peppers Under the Bridge or Pearl Jam Better Man, something like that. I've done a few through my career at different clubs, so I can't remember exactly. But you know what? Surprisingly, and it's not going to do his record sales any good, but Joey Champness was one of the worst. Was one of the worst initiation songs that I've heard in my 20-year career. And coming from a professional rapper, and we'd play his stuff in the change room, and he's a great, great artist and a very talented kid. But it was funny. He just could barely spit a rhyme, as they say, in front of the boys. And I think because it's one of those where you're more nervous performing in front of your mates than 50,000 people.
Yeah, fair enough. Did you want to alternate these, Patrick?
Yeah, sure. Who has the best dress sense and who has the worst?
Oh, again, that's opinion, and being one of the old boys that rock up in their Puma trackies day in, day out, I don't have too much power in this department. But, Dimmy is probably a pretty sharp dresser as well because, you know, he's trying to start his own label, I think, at the moment, and he's just confident in what he can wear and will pull off an open Hawaiian shirt or a leather jacket.
Great.
And the worst?
Oh, for the worst over my time, probably Daniel Lins-Cortez at Phoenix, because I'm sure he only owned one or two T-shirts, and he would just wear them even when it was freezing cold in Wellington. He'd just have this horrible stripy T-shirt on, and Javiana's from Brazil. So I think just a lack of effort gives him that.
Yep, fair call. Who had the best taste in music and who had the worst taste in music?
Well, again, I'm a bit of a rocker, so any of the boys that are into live music got a vote from me. And worst music, some of the Foreigners stuff is very, very hard to listen to, and especially when you don't understand the lyrics to some of the Spanish stuff, especially, is a tough one.
Who drives the best car? And who drives a clanker?
Well, Wellington, we all had clankers because it was Wellington, and there was no point spending money on a car to drive down Courtney Place. Dimmy at the moment's got a Mini Cooper. I'm not sure what year it is, but I think it's his third car for the season after a Mercedes four-wheel drive and I think a convertible he brought for his little brother. So not a big car guy myself anyway.
And no worries. Who spent the most time in front of the mirror?
Easily Shane Smeltz.
Yes.
Easily Shane by a mile. It would be a whole procedure of moisturizing, grooming, blow drying. It was, if you're lucky enough to be rooming with Smeltzy, you're late for every meeting, honestly. It's just, I just got to do this, I just got to do that. But
yeah.
I've known Smeltzy since we're in high school, so I can say that.
Who's the best player that you've played with?
Oh, yeah, it's another tough one. I can't point anyone out specifically.
You could use Smeltzy again to make up for calling him out on his mirror time.
Look, obviously Smeltzy's up there. Everyone knows Smeltzy. Yeah. But, I mean, we nicknamed him the Seagull because he would just kind of do nothing for 89 minutes and then swoop and, you know, pick up a chip and, you know, make the headlines the next day. I've been lucky enough. Costa Barbarous, Osmaco Rojas, these young Kiwi guys that have exploded onto the scene, I'll stick with the Kiwi guys. I think is the easiest answer.
I like that.
Best player you played against?
Ooh, Ronaldinho, Kaká, Ronaldo, Adriano, Roberto Carlos, Fernando Torres, Beckham. Yeah, I've been lucky with the Kiwi sides to play against, you know, some of the best players in the world at the time.
Yeah, there's that Brazil game, right? Huge. Who do you hate?
That one game.
Well, yeah, a lot. Who do you hate to face amongst the current A-League players? Who do you, when you know they're going to come up against on the weekend, who you really hope that they don't pop up in the box?
There's no one that jumps to mind. I mean, I guess you look at each club season, and it's usually the guys in form that that you do tend to watch out for without paying too much attention to, because if you worry too much about Castro, then Fornaroli will hurt you. You know, if you worry too much about McLaren, then someone else will hurt you. It's just the way it goes at club football. But obviously, Macca at Melbourne City has been on fire this season. And then Fornaroli, Castro, those guys that have been doing it year after year, are always danger players, I guess.
Anyone stand out as the best or up there as the best jokester or prankster in the squads you played with?
the pranks is it's a dying art form, actually. The next generation are too sensitive. So, I mean, when I was coming up, I'd finish training and there'd be no tires on my car, and you'd go into the change room and your jeans would just be missing, and you'd have to go to your car that's got no tires on it with no pants on at the same time. And that was all just laughed off by the manager as he drove out the gate as well. Unfortunately, now, the times are a little bit different and you've probably got to be a bit more sensitive in those areas. But in terms of banter, Jason Hoffman's, right up there. And when he gets alongside Topper Stanley and Ben Kanarowski, it's, you either love being in that row on the aeroplane or you want to be as far away from it as possible.
And I think this is the last one that we'll ask you today. I think I know the answer from 5 years ago when I asked you the same question, but if you'd never become a footballer, what would you have done instead?
Oh, you'll have to dig that answer out for me, because, again, going into retirement now, the answer could be a bit different. Obviously, I love the cafe work. I'm a fully qualified barista thanks to the kind sponsors I had at Mojo Coffee back in Wellington. Those guys were awesome. Put me and Jura through a qualified barista course in the off season, and that's how much we loved coffee. We wanted to learn. We're looking at investing in a franchise and those sorts of things. So anything around cafes, coffee, the social culture is amazing. And I can't wait till the world gets back up and running and wakes up and life returns as normal.
Well, that's the thing, right? We can start going back to coffees, conversing and going watching football and have the A-League back, hopefully.
That's
nice. Yeah. Hey, thank you so much for joining us, Mossy. It is super appreciated. And if we see you on the football field again, amazing. But if not, thank you very much for an outstanding career and a great 10 or so years of watching you play football. So
I really appreciate it, guys. And you'll see me around the game in the future, that's for sure.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for joining us, Mossy. And thanks, Patrick, for partnering up with this interview, mate. Really appreciate it.
No worries. Let's do it again sometime, eh?
Yeah, I think we might.
Sounds good.
I'm looking forward to the next Jets Phoenix players that you have online. I'll be looking forward to that.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it too. Hey, thanks, guys. All the best.
Okay, cheers, guys. Bye.